I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This time we're talking about poetry with one of the leading poets in America today, Mary Jo Salter. Her new book is a collection of new and selected poems called A Phone Call to the Future. Mary Jo Salter, welcome to Open Source.
Thank you so much for having me.
It strikes me, you're a famous teacher at Mount Holyoke and Johns Hopkins in real life, married to a teacher. But there's a lot of teaching in these poems, teaching about form, about beauty, about womanhood, wifehood, artistic life, family life, life in America, paying for a war that shocks us, life in a time of transition where people our age feel like fossils sometimes in a digital culture. But I'd love to think of this book as a kind of manual, most especially for the young people in high school and college that read it, and particularly people of the female persuasion. And I'd love you to begin with a poem called Poetry Slalom, which seems to me to be kind of an invitation to the thrills and chills, the highs and lows of the expressive life. I mean, your life as a poet.
I'd be happy to. Okay, here it is. Poetry Slalom. Much less the slam than the slalom gives me a thrill. That solemn, no-fuss Olympian skill in skirting flag after flag of the bloody obvious. The fractional lag while speeding downhill at the key moment in a sort of whole-body trill. The note repeated but elaborated, more touching and more elevated for seeming the thing to be evaded.
Writing poetry is a variation on downhill skiing.
Well, I should confess that I do not downhill ski myself, and the one time I tried to cross-country ski, I fell and ripped up my wrist and needed an operation. So I hope never to ski again. But really where this poem started was, as often happens with me, I misread words, and I was reading the newspaper and read the word, the phrase poetry slam, and misread it as slalom. And I thought, you know, I might actually prefer a slalom to a slam. And the way language can be accidentally so appropriate for poetry sort of slams into you, it's funny to me that the word slalom conveys that one ought to not slam into things. So this one word with just, you add just a few letters and you have an opposite, which was sort of fun too.
What part of the poet's life, I'm wondering, sort of feels like dangerous skiing, Olympic skiing?
Well, you're hoping for the Olympian skill. You're certainly not going to get there. As I say in the poem, you're trying to skirt flag after flag of the bloody obvious. You're hoping to say something true but not obvious, and you're also hoping to do it in some really cool and graceful and unexpected way. I mean, your reader knows to expect that you're going to go around that pole somehow, but they don't know how you're going to do it. They don't know what rhyme you might use or what image you might use. And so there's something, and also once you've done it, it's hard to undo it. I mean, you can go back up to the top of the hill and ski down again, but it's a dangerous business putting words on paper, because you can convince yourself sometimes too quickly that was the right way to do it. And sometimes you have to say to yourself, I have a really good idea here, but that was not the way to approach it. I have to start again.
Change of pace. Would you be so kind as to read Video Blues, partly because it's light, also because it's written to a very precise, exotic form, which we'll talk about.
Of course. This is Video Blues, and it's a villanelle, which is a French form that actually has become more popular recently. Video Blues. My husband has a crush on Myrna Loy and likes to rent her movies for a treat. It makes some evenings harder to enjoy. The list of actresses who might employ him as their slave is too long to repeat. My husband has a crush on Myrna Loy Carol, sorry, I'll back up. The list of actresses who might employ him as their slave is too long to repeat. My husband has a crush on Myrna Loy, Carol Lombard, Paulette Goddard, coy Jean Arthur with that voice as dry as wheat. It makes some evenings harder to enjoy. Does he confess all this just to annoy a loyal spouse? I know I can't compete. My husband has a crush on Myrna Loy. And can't a woman have her dreamboats? Boy, I wouldn't say my life is incomplete, but some evening I could certainly enjoy 2 hours with Cary Grant as my own toy. I guess, though, we were destined not to meet. My husband has a crush on Myrna Loy, which makes some evenings harder to enjoy.
Explain that form, with lines that repeat and then finally come together.
That's right. It's 19 lines. We have a series of three-line stanzas followed by the last one, which is a quatrain, 4 lines. And the game is that you have to have 2 refrains that alternate and then join. And so in the case of this poem, it was "My husband has a crush on Myrna Loy, which makes some evenings harder to enjoy." The other trick is that you have only 2 rhyme sounds that you have to use for all 19 lines. So one of them is that Loy and Joy sound, and the other would be treat, repeat, wheat, etc.
Mm. What's your investment these days in form itself? I've mapped the rhymes and the patterns, the visual impressions, the structures of these poems as best I can, but what is that driving at?
Well, I think it's largely a temperamental thing. I think people have gotten there's certainly a strain of how do I explain this? I'm going to start again. I think some people feel that rhyming or not rhyming is some sort of moral obligation, that it makes you a better or worse poet. And I don't feel that at all. I feel it's temperamental. And for me, when I work in rhyme, which I don't always do, but I usually do, I love the feeling not only that I've created a music and that things chime with each other, but with any luck, I'm creating some kind of rhyme between the meanings of those words. And sometimes that can be a contrast, night and light, for example. Other times it's more of, or the contrast I was talking about earlier with slam and solemn. That's not a rhyme, but it's working like one. Other times you want actually to create, especially with funnier poems, you want to create a surprise for the reader that they would never have thought, for example, in a poem about watching videos, that you were going to get the word wheat. Jean Arthur with that voice as dry as wheat. If it works, then it's a funny surprise. If it doesn't, it'll look like you're just straining. And so the challenge is to surprise your reader, but not in a way that strikes them as too much of a stretch. I think I have this right. I'm paraphrasing the poet Robert Graves, but he said at one point that rhyme is like Christmas. You know you're going to get some presents, but you don't know what they are.
the title poem of this book, and among the new poems, is "A Phone Call to the Future," and I'm sure there's a reason why it became the title poem. But would you read it and then comment? It's about all of us who've experienced both the analog and the digital worlds.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Okay, it's in 3 parts, and it's a longer poem. A Phone Call to the Future. 1. Who says science fiction is only set in the future? After a while, the story that looks least believable is the past. The console television with 3 channels, black and white picture, manual controls. The dial clicks when you turn it like the oven. You have to get up and walk somewhere to change things. You have to leave the house to mail a letter. Waiting for letters. The phone rings, you're not there. You'll never know. The phone rings and you are. There's only one. You have to stand or sit plugged into it. A cord confines you to the room where everyone is also having dinner. Hang up the phone. The family's having dinner. Waiting for dinner. You bake things in the oven, or Mother does. That's how it always is. She sets the temperature. It takes an hour. The patience of the past. The typewriter forgives its own mistakes. You type on top sheet, carbon, onion skin. The third is yours, a record of typeovers, clotted and homemade-looking, like the seams on dresses cut out on the dining table. The sewing machine, the wanting to look nice. Girls who made their dresses for the dance. 2. This was the 50s, as far back as I go. Some of it lasted decades. That's why I remember it so clearly. Also because, as I lie in a motel room sometime in 2004, scrolling through 77 channels on my back, there ought to be more, this is a cheap motel room, I can revisit evidence, hear it ringing. My life is movies and tells itself in phones. The rotary phone, so dangerously languid and loud when the invalid must dial the police. The killer coming up the stairs can hear it. The detective ducks into a handy phone booth to call his sidekick. Now at least there's touch tone. But wait, the killer's waiting in the booth to try to strangle him with a handy cord. The cordless phone, first noted in the crook of the neck of the secretary as she pulls life-saving files. Files come in drawers, not in the computer. Then, funny computers, big and slow as ovens. Now the reporter's running with a cell phone larger than his head, if you count the antenna. They're Martians, all of these people, perhaps the strangest being the most recent. I bought that phone. I thought it was so modern. Phones shrinking year by year, as stealthily as children growing. 3. It's the end of the world. Or people are managing after the conflagration, after the epidemic, the global thaw. Everyone's stunned. Nobody combs his hair. Or it's a century later, and although New York is gone, and love, and everyone is a robot or a clone or some combination, you have to admire the technology of the future. When you want to call somebody, you just think it. Your dreams are filmed without a camera. You can scroll through the actual things that happened, and nobody disagrees. No memory. No point of view. None of it necessary. Past the time when the standard thing to say is that, no matter what, the human endures. That whatever humans make of themselves is therefore human. Past the transitional time when humanity as we know it was there to say that. Past the time we meant well but were wrong. It's less than that, not any more a concept. Past the time when mourning was a concept. Of course, such a projection, however much I believe it, is sentimental, belief being sentimental. The thought of a woman born in the fictional 50s. That's what I mean. We were Martians. Nothing stranger than our patience, our humanity, inhumanity, our worrying about robots, earplug cell phones that make us seem to be walking about like loonies talking to ourselves. Perhaps we are. All of it was so quaint, and I was there. Poetry was there. We tried to write it.
I'm struck by that line, my life is movies. And tells itself in phones, including phone calls to the future. But what is changing, and what's at risk, do you think, are you saying, in the human?
Well, I think a lot of people of my generation have a kind of fear of the very technology that they've benefited from. I know I do. I mean, I'm as addicted to anybody as to my cell phone and my email. But there is something scary about, on the one hand, feeling that you're behind, you don't really understand what the latest thing is that's been developed. And on the other hand, that if you were to go along with it, would you ask yourself, would you in fact lose some aspect of what you thought it was to be human? So that if it really is true that we're going to have all sorts of genetic engineering, or we're going to have little nanorobots in our blood or whatever, I mean, that there's a feeling that we're messing with it, with what it is to be human. And if that is the case, what would we consider the sort of apex of the essence of being human? It would be art. It would be the making of art. And for me, that's poetry, although music in some ways I think is greater art because you don't use words. But in any case, I feel nostalgic in advance about the possible loss of poetry and of systems, things we work on that kind of reaffirm what we used to think of as humanity.
Mm. That jumps a track to a question I always want to ask a poet these days is, how is poetry doing itself? What is the life of poetry in our country today, do you think?
Well, in some ways, it's a lot better than when I first started publishing books. My first book came out in 85, and I was extremely lucky back then to have a book of poems taken. It's even harder today to publish a book with a major publisher that is actually willing to put something between covers for you. On the other hand, it's better in that because of the invention of the internet and because that technological advance, and also something completely untechnological, which is the growth of oral poetry, poetry slams and things like that, there are lots of ways for people who don't publish their books between covers to get their poetry out there in the world. So the good news is that more people are able to share what they write. I suppose another thing that would be bad news, though, is that the standards, what you or I might have thought of as the classics of poetry, are much less likely to be read. And you can't assume in most classrooms that your students have read, you know, the standards. I have to say I was just delighted. I've just started teaching at Johns Hopkins, and I just finished teaching a course on war poetry, and we began with a section of the Iliad, and we were not going to read all of it, but I said, how many of you have actually read all of the Iliad, even if you've forgotten it by now because it was a while ago? And almost everyone raised his or her hand, and this is a miracle. You know, that is not the case in most classrooms. And so how do you write poetry that has any elusiveness today also to the past if you're fairly sure that even the people who love poetry out there may not have read what you're referring to?
And what substituted for it, do you think, in the minds of young people today?
Well, to a large extent, it's music and song lyrics, and as I say, I'm in favor of that. I think it's great, and I write lyrics myself, and I love all of that. But I would hope that it wouldn't be a replacement for poetry. I would just hope that it would be something else that's got poetry in it that people love. And then, of course, you know, the obvious answer would be television, but I think, you know, television and radio, and they can, and are, and in your case, for example, this program, I mean, they can be used to disseminate poetry. So I'm not convinced that poetry off the page is the enemy in any way. It's just that I worry sometimes about how we're going to keep the poetry that is on the page out there in front of the public, and as something that you would just naturally pick up in the bookstore.
It's a privilege to hear it read, and especially by the author who reads so beautifully. And speaking of war poetry, there's a segue. Would you read your own Song of the Children from April 2005, 2 years into the war in Iraq?
Yes, sure. And I must say, when I wrote this poem 3 years ago, I honestly thought we would be out of the war in Iraq by now, but we're not. Song of the Children, April 2005. 2 years since the spring of the invasion, a well-conducted symphony of fireworks on the screen. I sit at home, half humming a tune from miles away inside my brain. I think I know at least the song's refrain. In the end, it's about the children. In the end, it's about the children. What's wrong with me? The music isn't coming. What is the grass? The child asked Whitman, gathering strangeness in his outstretched palms. All flesh is grass, said Brahms in well-aimed thunder, merciless and grand. What is this hook the child is left with, he who lost two parents and a sister and a hand? Who bears the cost? How can I tell him, I who can barely look? A shrug, then. Fate is fickle. So many soldiers won't be getting older. As another year's worth of recruits hoists its rifles, shoulder to young shoulder, another pen rests on my ink-stained knuckle. I have been spared, it seems, for another year to compose the awkward rags of my regrets. In the end, it's about the children. In the end, it's about the children. Another year has curled in on itself. Under the wheels of Humvees caked with dust, the turning, half-cocked world is skewered on its axis. My pen is angled, too, is glad enough to bleed into long ranks and files of taxes. Before my country's army rolling forward, I write my check, the white flag of a coward.
Hmm. Mary Jo Salter, that's the rather rare public or political poem in this book. How should we hear it?
Well, I think political poetry is dangerous in the opposite way that most things are dangerous. You think of danger as being something that might hurt you, and political poetry is dangerous in that it might think it can do a lot more than it can. I don't think that anybody who is a proponent of the Iraq War would read my poem and then decide not to be in favor of it. I don't think that's what poetry does. It's an expression of the feeling of the author, and it's reaching out to readers who may or may not disagree, but at least one hopes will respond to it as an expression, as a true and honest expression. And I think if you want to stop the war, you probably should write an editorial or something. I don't think that poetry really changes minds in that way. But it was something I felt I needed to write, and it helped me clarify for myself what's the most important casualty of war for me. What's the most terrible thing about it? And it's terrible that we lose soldiers, but it's even more terrible that innocent children die.
It was a big deal for a moment anyway when a rather large number of American poets declined Mrs. Bush's invitation to the White House and did poetry teach-ins or read-ins around the country early in the war. Where have the poets gone on this war?
Well, you know, I was one of the people invited, and I actually went. She had invited a number of poets. Then she canceled it because so many people refused to go, and then she invited a number of people, or through the Library of Congress, which was really organizing it, to be part of the National Book Festival, which is not just poetry. And I decided to go because I felt that the government ought to be supporting poetry. And it just so happened that the day of this National Book Festival happened to be a day of a large anti-war demonstration on the Mall in Washington. And so my pathetic little gesture was to get up there and to say, I'm so glad to see all of these protesters here, and I'm also glad to see all the writers here. And it's an uneasy balance we strike, I think. I believe that, as I say, I believe that governments should be supportive of the arts, but I also recognize why any poet would be, or any writer would be, so appalled by what we're doing that he or she felt they couldn't participate.
What about the artist's responsibility to speak rather sharply to his government, as Leon Fleischer, the pianist, did, for example, this past spring?
Oh, I applaud him. I loved what he said, because he wrote about his own wrestling with whether or not he should go. And I think that's the important thing. It's not – you didn't feel with him that he was posing, that he was doing it just to draw attention to himself or his – you know, that it was really about his strongest beliefs, that he felt he – you know, I completely understand why somebody would refuse to participate. You know, I guess my point is that I don't think that poetry itself – is usually the best means to make that statement. So, or that art itself often is the best way. So that Leon Fleisher, he's not going to sit down at the piano and do an anti-war concerto. He's going to speak as Leon Fleisher and say, "This war appalls me."
Mary Jo Salter, I'd love you to read the first poem in your new book called "Wake Up Call." And I'd love to talk with you a little bit after we've heard it about the American dreams running all through it.
Sure. Thank you. This is Wake Up Call. The water is slapping, wake up, against the boat chugging away from Venice, infinite essence of what must end because it is beautiful. Venice that shrinks to a bobbing, pungent postcard, and then to nothing at all as the automatic doors at the airport obligingly shut behind you. Re-enter a world where everything's much the same, where you've gone slack again and don't even know it, so unaware that you actually shrug to yourself, "I'll be back." And yes, for some lucky stiffs, it's true. Sometimes it's you. You're sure to get more chances at Venice and Paris and that blessed, unmarked place where you sat on a bench and he kissed you that first time. So many kisses, you hoped he would never stop. You can hope, at least, not ever to forget it. Or forget how your babies, latching onto your breast, would roll up their eyes in an ecstasy that was comic in its seriousness, though your joy was no less grave. But you're not going back to so much, and more, the longer you live, there's more not to go back to. And what you demand in your gratitude and greed is more life in which to get so attached to something, someone, or someplace, you're sure you'll die right then when you can't have it back. Something you don't even know the name of yet, but will be yours before receding as an indispensable ache. What you're saying is, "Lord, surprise me with even more to miss."
That's a wonderful and provocative last line. "Lord, surprise me with even more to miss." But again, coming back to where we began, I'm thinking of young people reading this poem, Mary Jo Salter, and hearing an extremely familiar set of American hopes, middle-class aspirations to travel, to babies,
yes.
And at the end to more, more, more.
Yes, it's true. And actually, I was really pleased that an Italian friend of mine put this poem in an anthology of poems about Venice. It was translated into Italian. And I thought, you know, it was such an honor to me because I was so worried that this would be the worst cliche. We're back to this fear of cliches that poets have. And I was hoping that what would come through is exactly what you're saying, that this is an American version of having everything. The American version is you get Paris and you get Venice and you get love and you get babies. The love and babies are universal, of course, but that's the whole thing. And so I tried, I guess, to show my own awareness of how cliched or conventional this dream is by, for example, having Venice shrink to a postcard as it gets smaller and smaller as you're leaving. And it actually, the poem began in, this is rare that a poem begins exactly the way I thought of it the first time, but I woke up and I was hearing a water slap on the sides of the boat and I was in Venice and I have no idea why I was in Venice in this dream, but I suddenly realized that this was my personal paradise. This was my Eden, and I was leaving.
And it must end because it's beautiful.
Yes, yes. And that we're all very greedy. We want everything. And, you know, you can't pretend that you're not. And so I guess in talking about gratitude and greed, I try to put those two alliterative words together because if you're going to be greedy, you might as well at least acknowledge how lucky you are to have whatever it is that you do have. I guess the other thing about the poem that is very middle-aged is just this notion that you not only want all that stuff, which we all want everything from day one, but you want enough time that you can remember it later. And, you know, the older you get, you don't know whether you're going back physically to that place, Venice or Paris, but you also don't know, even if you're sitting in Ohio, you don't know how many years you have to remember being in Venice or Paris.
I'd love you to read, finally, the Obad to Brad, which is another poem about poetry and about writing, but also about wifehood and American couples.
Sure. I wrote this for my husband, whose name is Brad, and so it's Obad for Brad.
Obad meaning?
It's Obad is a French form, and it means a morning song, a morning poem, and usually it involves the reluctance of either the poet or the loved one to get up, to wake up. Hmm. It's a dawn poem. Obad for Brad. At 6 o'clock begins the ritual dance of bumping into bureaus in the dark. It's time you went to work. Holding one shoe at arm's length like a candle, you grope for its mate, but stumbling on a sandal of mine, abandon hope and ask for guidance in the softest voice. I whisper too, as if there's still a chance we might not wake me up. Once shod, you pull the creaking blinds whose slats narrow their sleepy eyelids into slits, and I'm to take the cue, more sloth is my reward for finding you the means by which you'll disappear till dinner. Condemned to write from dawn until you drop in bed at night, you'll spend a happy, virtuous day convinced you are a miserable sinner. No doubt it is the hard fate of the writer to suffer like the rest, but not know better than to call it a job. What's worse than feeling so deeply one must doubly force oneself to show it in both prose and verse? I sympathize, of course. So much, in fact, I'd joyfully disprove that formula by which all energy converts to printed matter and devote this morning some of it to love. Darling, if you'll untie your shoes again and lie for a moment here, while the sun turns all to gold, I may grow very bold.
I take it as an invitation here to your readers to become writers, too. You're pitching the life of poetry, I think.
Yes, and as I say about my husband, he must doubly force himself to show it in both prose and verse. He has the misfortune of being a novelist as well as a poet, and we both have the misfortune of being insomniacs. This poem was written, a very long time ago, and we've only gotten worse in terms of our insomnia. Yes, I think it is a way of both poking fun at the life of the writer and saluting it at the same time. And the notion that our version of virtue is to sit there at the desk and it's a virtue to sit there. And yet so much of what poets write about is about suffering. So it can be a kind of dishonest thing to sit there having that much fun writing about suffering. But I suppose that's part of it.
Mary Jo Salter, it's a great privilege and pleasure to hear you on Open Source and to be led through a kind of manual of life as well as literature. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.